Today we look at heart. Stephen Wooner is known as Earth Poet, Senior Researcher for the Foundation of Gaian Studies, teacher, and author. He walks many paths getting to the heart of any matter. Today he's sharing about his book, The Secret Teachings of Plants, The Intelligence of the Heart and the Direct Perception of Nature. It's timeless wisdom from both Mother Nature and from Stephen himself. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
As an introduction to you and your book, I'm wondering if you would describe what it's like when you let the field of your heart range out far beyond you.
Well, you know, I think everybody is used to doing that in our culture. It's just not something that's talked about, and so most people aren't consciously aware of that that's what they're doing. You know, everybody's had that kind of experience where you get home and you walk in the house and you expect that somebody's home, but there's actually no one there. And so you're walking around and you kind of start feeling, gee, it feels like the house is empty. And then pretty soon you find out indeed that it is. Or another example is, you know, you see a dog laying, you know, in somebody's yard and you're walking up and the dog isn't growling or being hostile in any way, but it's not necessarily wagging its tail. And as you get closer, you start to feel, you know, I think that dog isn't really friendly. And pretty soon you find out the dog isn't friendly. And that's really very common experiences of what it feels like when you have your heart field extended. And when it contacts or touches the fields given off by other living beings or even a house. I mean, you can tell when there isn't a living being's heart field in the house itself. And so it's basically my work and my writing, and a lot of it is about learning how to turn that into a very sophisticated tool for information gathering and for reconnection and with the world itself.
Well, I felt that after reading your book that I know why the teachings of plants are secret. And it isn't that they are hidden, but it's because not many of us are really looking.
Well, that's a really good point. You know, within a lot of mystical traditions or different spiritual traditions or even working with the deeper teachings of plants in different lineages, there's this kind of common concept that, oh, these mysteries are hidden and all of that, as if it's some secret thing that only the people in the know, you know, can know about, and you have to be like, maybe we'll let you know or not. And it's not really that way. You're very right about that. Things are hidden not in the sense that they're made secret, but that they have to be perceived with other capacities than the linear mind. And as you begin to develop those ways of perception in yourself, you begin to see that there's this whole living world of communication that's going on all of the time that you've been kind of walking in the midst of completely oblivious for a long time.
That's so true. In, you know, we may be so focused in one area, and this is something that you bring out so brilliantly in your book, and you do actually almost model it like the heart is lots of times modeled, where it's systolic and diastolic. And you state right away that the heart is an organ of perception. And I'm wondering if you would talk about that. The first part of the book is linear, and you cite a lot of wonderful research that has been going on, which actually, even the focus of research is opening up beautifully lately, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And, you know, it's the 19th century mechanistic reductionists are all getting older and dying off, and there's these new generation of people that are casting further afield for ways to understand the world and their place in it. And so slowly in science, as in everything else, the paradigm is starting to be shifted because people are willing to look at what's so, not some theory or model that they've inherited in their schooling. And, you know, there's still a tremendously long way to go, but they are doing great stuff. And, you know, one of the things I say in the book, it's completely absurd on the one hand to think about, you have these scientists getting paid millions of dollars and using all this money to at last pronounce, after decades of research, that, yes, the heart is actually the seat of emotions, you know, and it's like, you know, there's something wrong with that picture. And everybody goes, yeah, I knew there was something to that, but... You know, it's like, and that's part of the problem for me, is that we've given up our ability to know the world directly to all of these experts who then tell us what we already knew anyway. And there's something really wrong with that. Nevertheless, it is still great that a lot of the research that's being done is becoming more available and more known. And one of the things that, of course, I think is tremendously important is this whole concept of perceiving with the heart. I mean, what people are finding is that consciousness is not located, it's not stuck in a particular place in the body like the brain. It can relocate itself to any of the primary biological oscillators in the body, and we have three of them, the heart, the brain, and the GI tract. So, you know, that's why certain cultures and certain ancient or indigenous cultures, why if you ask them where they live in their body, they would gesture to the region of the heart, not the head. They thought it was crazy if you lived in your head all of the time. And, you know, the brain is a great computer used for processing data, and it's very important, but it's not where you can live an ensouled life, and it's not where you can live a life and feel caring for things. It's hard to be careful with the world if you're in your head, because the brain is amoral. It has no inherent moral structure.
As you state in your book and live in your life also, I'm sure, direct perception of nature is obviously key to understanding anything about life. And yet in your book, you do share a lot of your findings about the heart. And I guess I have to admit, even though I do live more intuitively in my life, I'm still a junkie for those scientific things that come out, not because they surprise me, but as you stated earlier, they just put this little smile of knowing on my face, like, yeah, okay, so what else is new? And one of the things you bring up in your book is about, first of all, the heart isn't just a pump, or if it is a pump at all, in my mind, but...
No, it's not. I mean, that definition of the heart came from the 19th century. It's basically steam engine mechanics applied to human physiology. And, you know, from where they were 150 years ago, yeah, it was kind of a good analogy, but it's not accurate by any means. The blood begins to flow in the body before the heart is developed enough to pump it. And some physicists did this great study, and they figured out exactly how much the heart, you know, could the heart actually really pump the blood around the body? And they found out actually, no, it can't. It doesn't have the strength to do that. It stabilizes the pumping action, but it's a lot more important than that, because the blood reaches every cell in the body. What happens is, by the heart being hooked into the circulatory system, the hormones it releases and the pressure waves it creates and the, you know, neurotransmitters it makes and releases as it needs them, they affect every cell in the body. So it's able to do this tremendous maintenance function, which is very elegant. But even beyond that, it's got this, you know, it's a bioelectromagnetic generator that generates a field 5,000 times stronger than the brain. It can be measured by scientific instruments up to 10 feet away from the body, though, of course, it goes much farther than that. We just don't have instruments sensitive enough. So, you know, one of the reasons I spend so much time in the first half of this book talking about all of the scientific developments is because our model of the universe is deeply flawed. We've been taught untrue information. And so, one of the things I've been trying to do in all of my books is a symbol, an accurate representation of the universe in which we live, so that we can start to perceive what's really there rather than have our innate responses denigrated by how our brain goes, well, wait a minute, that can't be accurate because, you know, I read in, when we learned in school, you know, people don't do that. So it, the, there's a part of us that needs to know how the world works, and so this supplies that kind of information. And in that sense, it's deeply satisfying because it lets us have something to point to when we run into a mechanical reductionist who begins to denigrate
my
our
father.
Yeah, right. All of our parents, you know.
Well, just as we've been speaking, a lab can look at blood, but by the time it gets to the lab, it's really a totally different substance than that which is circulating through our body. And I loved how you continued and furthered your study by looking at being an herbalist and how it's difficult to do that part and then strictly only use Western diagnostic or Chinese diagnostics for looking at particular problems in the body, and that not a lot of people even think of that.
Well, Western, most people don't realize that Western diagnostic processes are wrong 50% of the time. And, you know, one of the standard complaints about physicians is you go in to see them and you don't feel really nurtured and cared about many of the times when you're in there. It's kind of like a processing station, and they stick you in one end and process you out the other. But this other kind of work is very different. You know, there's a very long tradition in the human species of a very different kind of diagnostics and very different kind of healing work with people, and probably the best look at it from an indigenous perspective is a book called Wizard of the Upper Amazon by Manuel Cordova Rios, or it's by Bruce Lamb, but it's about Manuel's work. And he did that kind of diagnosis and was trained in it from a teenager. And what happens when you're using the heart field as a diagnostic medium, it engenders this tremendous empathy with the people that you work with. It, things aren't theoretical anymore. It's not like you have this theoretical picture and you're fitting the person into it. You're literally engaging with the living reality of the person themselves and their particular predicament that they're in. And so you are connected to the flow of their life in this very unique way. And I found so many times when somebody has a suffering like that, the one essential thing that they need in addition to healing and help is they need companionship in that suffering.
Connection, exactly.
So this is such a very different way of doing work, but yet it's very much the oldest that our species has known.
And is that what you call depth diagnosis in your book?
Yes, it is. And, you know, because I'd been very interested for years in how did indigenous people elicit the understanding of the medicinal uses of plants. They would say, you know, well, the plant told me. I didn't know, this wasn't trial and error. And every indigenous and ancient culture on Earth said some version of that. It came in a dream or a vision, or the gods told them, or the plant told them, you see. And their diagnosis systems were based on that same kind of process as well. They would literally be able to take in through the field of their heart the field of whatever living being that they're engaged with, if they're doing, because I look at how people have done this sort of diagnosis with ecosystems, our farm fields, our plants that are ill, our human beings, it doesn't really matter. And you merge your heart field and the energetic field around those other beings, there's a harmony of patterning, an entrainment that occurs at a certain point, which the indigenous people very carefully described in many instances. And in that moment of entrainment, all of the information embedded in the electromagnetic field of that thing goes through the heart and is transmitted to the brain for analysis. And that's where those kind of intuitive flashes and hits come from that many New Age practitioners talk about. But it can be as sophisticated and as deep and as elegant as more reductionistic kinds of diagnosis. And probably the person that developed that the most was Goethe, the great German poet, who was also an amazing botanist.
I can see how it's an easy jump from being a naturalist to a poet and vice versa.
Well, you know, Thoreau, a lot of people think of Henry David Thoreau as a naturalist, and he was much more than that. He was really the first great American nature mystic, and his work is extremely detailed, but there's this poetic element that begins to enter the work of anybody who is deeply involved like that, and you see it in Thoreau's work, or the great Japanese farmer Masanobu Fukuoka. Our Bly is very deeply connected, and you just see a lot of this stuff because you begin reconnecting with this tremendous beauty that is inherent in the world in a deeply empathic way, and it begins to shape not only your own life, but how you speak about it, too.
I was so happy to find out about Masanoku in your book. He's a character in this play that I really had never heard of before.
Yeah, he's an astonishing man, and I discovered him quite a few years ago. Most people have heard of his first book, which is The One Straw Revolution, but he, you know, has learned how to grow food without tilling the soil, without using fertilizers or pesticides, or without weeding, and he equals or exceeds scientific yields every year, and, you know, he said, oh, I thought when I proved this by doing it for 20 or 30 years, they would listen to me. And he goes, but what do I know? I'm only a simple farmer. The scientists really have no use for this kind of knowledge.
Right. Right. I love the dumb farmers. You know, they're the ones that are also wearing that little smirk on their face.
Right. Well, you know, there's this ridiculous mistake a lot of people make. You know, farmers hang out with cows, and cows are stupid. Therefore, farmers are stupid.
Right.
And so I never had much use for that kind of logic. It doesn't work out. But nevertheless, there seems to be that kind of a socialization about it.
Now, Stephen, I know obviously you've been an herbalist for quite some time and you've been living in the United States. Have you traveled much to the rainforest or places like
no,
that?
No, I haven't. You know, I've spent some time in Europe and some time in Canada and a little bit of time in Mexico. But really, I'm a North American guy more than anything else. And most of my time has really been spent in the high Rocky Mountains range from New Mexico up through Montana. So that kind of wildness of the land has been really what spoke to me the most. And I've always thought it's kind of funny that people run off to South America looking for, you know, shamans, but they won't go to Arkansas to find an old herbalist. That
I know.
Stuff. So, you know, that's the real teachers for me really have been the wild landscapes and the plants of North America more than anything else.
Right. You speak about intimacy with plants beginning with chance encounters. Could you share one of yours with us?
Oh, sure. You know, there's really three kinds of plants that really have been my great teachers. And the first one is the kind that is you're just out walking and it just grabs your attention and you notice it because it's so beautiful, that there's some luminous or transcendent quality about it. And the second kind are the ones that trip you when you walk or stab you with thorns, and they're so invasive, they won't leave you alone. And you know, those are the two major ones. There's a third one, kind of coyote plants that freak you out through your enhanced sensitivity, but those don't happen too often. But, you know, one of the great ones for me was Osha, which is a plant that grows all around Boulder. It's a magnificent plant, and you know, I was very ill, and that was the plant that really began helping me in the beginning and teaching me this way of plant medicine. It's an astonishing plant. The root looks very much like a hairy bear that's been hibernating. And
did you feel like a hairy bear that was hibernating?
Well, the plant did, and it was that kind of strength of medicine that I needed. So, you know, I found that in great old trees sometimes that you come on unexpectedly in the forest. And there's something about them that causes you to pause, and you just take in this deep breath, and you're caught up in the power and the wonder of the thing. And you know, you think about how melancholy life can be sometimes, or how sad or depressing it can be, and people take, you know, antidepressants to counteract it. But when you walk in the forest and you encounter a tree like that, or in a grove of aspens that have that dancing lightness to them, and you begin to feel this lightness of spirit just from that contact, I mean, that is the original antidepressant. So for me, that kind of movement that has affected me so deeply, that really is the medicine itself.
Yes, I would agree. Now, there could be worry with our society's over 100 years focus on the cognitive side of things, and that the nonlinear or intuitive process could be lost. But I think it's almost acted in the reverse, in that it shows more obviously our intuitive moments really do stand out even more, so they get recognized perhaps more often.
Well, they do, because, I mean, everybody's had this experience. They're sitting around the house, and they go, the phone's going to ring, and the phone rings. You know, everybody's had that at least once or twice in their life, and there isn't any explanation for it. And it drives scientists nuts, you know, because they're like, well, you just made that up, and you made it up 1,000 times, and it just happened to work that time, you know. Yeah, sure. So it's really true in a large sense that by juxtaposition, that's how we know ourselves. And by being in a world that is so linear and cognitive reductionistic, these other experiences stand out in a real sharp relief because of that comparison. And in a way, we're finding the limits to that kind of linear reductionism. And so I think when we begin to reintegrate as a species this way of perception that is more intuitive and is more empathic, that we're going to have a much better balance than we've ever had in the history of the human species before.
Yes, I think it's pretty exciting. I think that you very wisely have reservations about the standardization of herbs and herbalists, and I'm wondering, is this an issue that is on the forefront right now?
Yeah, it's a real problem. You know, I'm from the 60s, you know, and so one of the things that happened back then were these tremendous healing movements of body work and psychotherapy, midwifery, herbs, all of these great things. And as all of those began to reach a certain penetration into the American culture and they became stable and more mature, all of the research that we'd all done in these various fields started to really pay off. Then the culture itself began to absorb them into itself and begin to try to control and restrict access and license and all of that stuff. And as soon as that happens, the work itself simply becomes a poor relation of medicine, of technological medicine, which isn't that good anyway. So, and it's now happening with herbs, which is the last great outlaw area of healing in the United States. And you know, they find more and more and more all of the time that when they standardize an herb, there's a few of them that, yes, indeed, it is true, the herb is much better standardized or potentized for one particular constituent, but the vast majority are not. And they find, yeah, you start to get more side effects sometimes when you do that, or it's not really that constituent, it was another one you didn't understand. And then, of course, they start trying to standardize the herbalist themselves, not recognizing that the last thing people need is more information. I mean, if information could help somebody
Perfect.
Be a good healer, I mean, we'd all be well already, you know.
That is a brilliant point. Absolutely. How do you find the healing properties of wild harvested herbs versus those grown on a farm?
It's the difference between a wolf and a domestic dog. And if you've ever looked into the eyes of a wolf or a coyote and then a domestic dog, you get a feeling impact immediately of the difference in the potency of the plant medicine. So, you know, it's a tough issue because so many people use herbs now that farm-grown herbs are really important to reduce the impacts on wild populations. Nevertheless, the wild populations are extremely important for renewing the potency of the domestic plants, just as it is with gardening. And, you know, the thing I'm really intrigued with now are invasive, so-called invasive species, because I'm finding in many regions where the invasive species are moving in, they're tremendously potent wild plants, in a sense, taking their space, but they also are accompanying the movement of new disease complexes as they move into cultures. Like out here in Vermont now, Lyme disease is becoming more and more of a problem, and these invasive species like wild chervil and Japanese knotweed are specific for that disease, and they showed up here exactly the same time Lyme did. So that's the thing I really love watching, is how these wild plant populations begin to bloom at a certain time, just when we need them.
Right. By that way, the goats will certainly be the healthiest animal left on the planet.
Yeah, if anybody's ever known a goat, I mean, they're totally healthy. They're unbelievable.
Yeah, and they're actually, I know goat farmers who are hiring their goats out to come and eat this stuff that's growing, and they don't want it there anymore.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know about that.
In writing The Secret Teachings of Plants, part one, as we've mentioned earlier, is linear, and part two is not. And I was wondering, as far as your own personal process in writing this book, was it easier to know when you were finished with part one or with part two?
Well, the neat thing for me about writing, if I'm doing some kind of linear thing, I can work on that if I don't feel good, you know, because I don't have to be emotionally on in the same way, and I can get that track laid down, so to speak, and then work on it later. Each book, I'm have to struggle to find the heart of it, and then it begins to emerge on its own. But the second half was a much more involved development, much more poetic, much more nonlinear, and it incorporated a lot of poetry and unusual stylistic development that I haven't seen used very many other places. So there was a certain flow and a pattern to it, almost like music, that I had to work very much to support that so that it could emerge in as pure a form as possible. So that, to me, writing is a real full-dimensional experience, because many nonfiction books are a lot like a grocery list, and they're about that interesting. But nonfiction can be this amazing art form where the words themselves, you know, are filled with meaning by the writer, and meaning piles up behind the word, almost like water behind a dam. So when you touch it, you know, it kind of releases the surface tension in the word, and then the meaning begins to pour out into the reader. And it's for something like this, when I'm talking about the heart as an organ of perception, a real focused goal for me was to generate the actual experience that I was talking about in the reader as they read it. And it's a very demanding process to actually create a work that comes alive like that.
But done very, very successfully. I noticed on the back of the book two people actually who have been guests on Tributary, Susan Weed and Joseph Chilton Pierce, who is one of my favorite people on the whole planet, both just give a lot of praise to your book, which is out on Bear & Company. So I'd like to thank you for your time today and for writing the book and for the wonderful work you're doing in the world.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Definitely one of my favorite guests, Stephen Bruner. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting on iTunes is at iTunes Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.